If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted again to be able to speak to accomplished UK fund manager Ken Wotton of Gresham House. So big welcome, Ken.
Thanks, Paul. Good morning. Good to be here.
Yeah, well, it's fab to have you back on the show. We've had lots of different cross currents hitting the market since we last spoke, not least, obviously, Trump's trade tariffs and the wars in Ukraine and Gaza. Now we've got the budget in 2 weeks' time. So putting all that together, given what's been happening actually with all the stocks and shares, what's your sort of outlook for equities over the next 12 months?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's sort of deja vu, isn't it, with the budget sort of being a big overhang and people sort of questioning what's going to happen to taxes, etc. It sort of seems like we're back where we were last year. Having said that, you know, I am seeing on the ground, you know, since the end of the summer, it does feel like the markets, despite all the sort of negative sort of sentiment and concerns about taxes, etc., that there's just a bit more activity. There's a few more companies that have been raising equity that, God forbid, there's actually been a couple of IPOs, and there's definitely sort of more in the pipeline. So it feels just a little bit better, sort of at the coal face, as it were. My personal sort of glass half full view is that, you know, if the budget just isn't as bad as everyone fears, if taxes are clearly going up, but if there's no sort of left field incremental negative stuff for companies, I actually think that could be a positive catalyst, because you've seen, you know, material US money coming into the UK market over the course of this year. And whilst we've still got outflows from domestic UK funds, the weight of money in the US is just so significant that it could really drive the market over the next 12 months. And I think it's probably paused, awaiting the budget just to see kind of what happens. But if it's just not terrible, then actually, I think that restarts. You've seen the FTSE 100 perform really strongly this year, and I think that's a necessary sort of precursor to small caps starting to perform. So the conditions are in place, and as long as we don't have a disaster at the end of the month, then, you know, hopefully we'll start to see some proper sort of movement in stocks for, you know, the first time in 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, which is a big ask, isn't it, that we don't want a disaster at the end of the month by what's happening in the first budget. But just more broadly, obviously, with we've had buying, obviously, lots of companies have been buying back their own shares. We've had lots of M&A, which says that valuations in the small cap sector are very attractive. But equally, when do you think the sort of that will stop the outflows of open-ended sort of unit trust in that small cap space? Because they seem to be the only sellers in town still.
Yeah, I mean, the irony is that, you know, there's a kind of structural reallocation within equity portfolios, particularly from UK wealth managers who are big owners of open-ended funds, from UK benchmarks to global benchmarks, and that necessitates effectively a selling of UK stocks and a buying of global funds, of which are dominated by US. And you could step back and say that's all happening right at the wrong time, when you've got the US at peak valuations, peak concentration within global portfolios, and peak sort of stock concentration within the US, and you're selling the UK, particularly UK small cap funds, when UK small cap valuations are at the widest discount they've been for decades versus the US. So it doesn't feel like the right time to be doing that. You know, I think it takes some positive momentum, which we have had, to be fair, in the large caps this year. And you know, you've got the UK becoming a slightly bigger proportion of global benchmarks again, and then you sort of start to see it moving the other way. But you know, it's sort of slightly dysfunctional, I'd say, at the moment.
Yeah, well, but it's a matter of when, it's not if. It's just the timing, getting it right, I guess. Okay, let's move to certain stocks. We've got Tim. He's asking about one of your real sort of like hot stock winners, which is Active Ops, which is a software company that helps sort of like financial services businesses and insurers to manage their workforces and to do sort of complex tasks. Their shares have performed very strongly of late, and then I think they had a well-received capital markets day. They now trade at quite a punchy 4x sales. They're just profitable. But what's your latest view on this business?
I think this business is, you're right to say, it's performed well over the last few months, but it's performed well from a pretty low base. You know, the company has delivered quite strongly, actually, since in terms of its operational performance since it IPO'd in 2021. But unfortunately for them, they IPO'd pretty much at the peak of the market and suffered from the general derating of growth stocks in the period post the beginning of 2022. But they've just plugged away and carried on focusing on the business. And the big recent catalyst was numbers coming in ahead of expectations and seeing forecast upgrades, and also a material, a pretty transformational acquisition that they made, which has really sort of added to their recurring revenue base. The business is accelerating its ARR, annual recurring revenue, which is the basis on which these type of stocks typically get rated. So, you know, we see a big addressable market, a great management team, a good product. You know, this is a company that is not directly selling AI stuff, is beneficiary of that big structural move to AI, where its software and the information, the data, the control that it gives an organization can enable those companies to implement AI solutions to drive efficiencies. So it's an indirect beneficiary of the kind of massive AI boom. And for that reason, you know, we think the momentum continues. And in that context, especially when you compare to either private market valuations or US valuations, 4x recurring revenue, just it's not that expensive.
I know they had a say that capital markets day, and I think it was one of their brokers, Canaccord, put out aspirational estimates of sort of like 100 million ARR in 3 to 5 years, and I think they're doing about 42-43 at the moment, which is a sort of like a combined average growth rate, I don't know, about 30% or something. But that's what they've just done. I mean, I guess the key question is this, it is, as it's a software business with 80% gross margins, you're going to see huge operating leverage if it gets anywhere near that positive. But is it going to be able to, is that 25-30% ARR growth sustainable? What's your sort of view?
Well, I think it is sustainable. The reason for that is that this is a player that is global in scope. So it's got companies that are using its services across the world. It is a huge potential addressable market for them. They have a fantastic blue chip customer base. Those customers could do a lot more with them, and a lot of their growth. And this is one of the reasons the risk reward here is really attractive. Is that a big proportion of their growth is selling more to their existing customers, but then they're also adding new logos as well, and then they have the potential to do bolt on acquisitions to add capability or customer bases as well. So, do I think that growth rate is sustainable? Yes, I do, and I think if they can get anywhere close to 100 million of ARR, they should be making well over 20% operating margins. And if they're doing that, you know, that then this will be generating significant cash. That cash can be reinvested into trying to drive more growth or M&A. So I think the story continues for at least 3 to 5 years at this kind of pace.
Yeah. Yeah, and I understand they actually did re-sort of sign a contract. They'd previous, a big contract. I think it was with a UK bank. Just and the bank decided it couldn't use a competitor because it wasn't good enough.
Yeah, so they went
back to them. which is a fabulous, obviously, statement. Okay, let's move to another very successful or long-term successful software company. We've got Jonathan. He's asking about a dealership software company, Pinewood Technologies. Mm-hmm. I think, if I remember rightly, was spun out of Pendragon, the car dealer, and Assigned inked a couple of deals to expand into the States with Lithia. Anyway, what's sort of your latest on this one?
Yeah, so this is another one which has had good operating momentum. It's another software as a service business. As you rightly say, it was spun away. It was actually left behind when Pendragon's auto dealership business was sold, and so they decoupled the two from each other, which actually was a pretty positive thing for Pinewood in terms of its ability to sell to other dealerships, because by becoming effectively independent of Pendragon, it removed a barrier that some of Pendragon's competitors may have perceived to be there, buying dealership management software from a direct competitor was kind of potentially quite tricky for some players in that space. And so it's growing really strongly. It's got multi-year recurring contracts, so the visibility is really good. Actually, the Pendragon sale to Lithia opened up Lithia as a big potential customer, and part of the terms of that transaction enabled them to effectively sell to Lithia. And there's a JV in the US which is now sort of driving growth as well. So, you know, I think again, it's another one similar to ActiveOps that has really good visibility of multi-year growth. And you can see on your chart here that the share price has pulled back a bit, having after a very strong run post that sort of divestment of the dealership business, and that was really down to a couple of timing issues, so just contracts moving to the right. But because of the nature of the contracts, because of the long-term visibility over them, you know, we don't see that as really a fundamental issue in terms of the valuation of the company in the longer term. So actually this pullback looks like a pretty decent buying opportunity to us.
Yeah, no, I'm with you actually, because I think the visibility gives them. I think they're doing about 26 million of EBITDA at the moment run rate, and they're trying to get to with just the rollout into that US, the Lithia joint venture. Well, it's now a joint venture; it's theirs, but 60 million, isn't it? I think is EBITDA, so they'll double it in 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And you know, this space has been historically over the last few years. There's been a few M&A transactions in private markets and you know, at really quite attractive valuation multiples, well ahead of where Pine was currently trading. So we see growth, but also re-rating opportunity here.
Okay, on that M&A theme or historically, we've got Jessica. She's asking about EdTech software company Tribal Group, which sort of like supplies all the management systems for universities in the UK. I think it's got a 60% market share and about 30% in Australia and New Zealand. It had a bit of a landmine, unfortunately, when it signed Singapore a few years ago, but that's sort of like luckily terminated and finished. And then it got a bid from one of the a rival, I think Lucidia, about sort of 12 months ago or 18 months ago, maybe 2 years ago, actually, at 74p. What's your sort of your latest on this one and whether it's going to get taken out at some point in time? Because it still trades well below the 74p cash offer that was made for it about two years ago.
Yeah, so if you kind of, you know, just think about bridging from that point from 2 years ago, where there was an offer from the private equity backed competitor, a 74p. That takeover offer was blocked by Genzbar, who are another trade player in this space, who own a big own 26% of the company. And so I think that's a bit frustrating for the management team, for other institutional shareholders like ourselves who on balance would have taken that price. But if you think back to 2 years ago, and you referenced it, the problem contract they had in Singapore, there was quite a lot of uncertainty around that. They've made a material provision to cover the costs of unwinding that contract, but it still wasn't entirely clear, you know, where the arbitration would get to and what the outcome would be. So if you roll forward to now, you know, they have, number one, kind of that's now kind of ring fenced and the numbers are clear. So the risk of something kind of coming out of the woodwork negatively on that has now receded. So that, you know, surely, apart from anything else, is a positive for the valuation. And then, you know, the company itself has made good operating progress. It's growing its core software business that's selling into the university sector. The proportion of the recurring revenue that's come from legacy contracts, which have been running off, has reduced materially. And you know, they've also restructured their services business so that it is potentially saleable, or at least sort of self-contained and is kind of doing all right. So, you know, put all those things together, the business is bigger, it's less risky. The quality of earnings or the mix of its revenue is now more favourable in towards the kind of bit that people value about this company. Yet the price is still below the 74p that was offered by a trade competitor 2 years ago. So for us, that just underpins the valuation opportunity that you've got here. This business has still got a really strong market position, so it's still an attractive asset for a competitor or for private equity to be interested in it. Genzibar, that shareholding is a problem, it may deter some investors from coming in, or it may deter a buyer. But equally, you know, there's plenty of other transactions. You saw that we just talked about Pinewood and the Pendragon spin-off. So there are sort of alternative transaction structures that can unlock value if it's not a sale of the whole company.
Yeah.
So, you know, we still think there's good value there.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I think it goes back to the original point we talked about in value in sort of small and mid caps, because I think they've got around about sort of 65 million ARR in that pure software business for the universities, which they're going to get to, I think it's 80 million in about 2 years' time. Three times 80 million, you get 240 plus, say, let's just only 10 million for the services business, 250 divided by share count of 215. You get 120p per share under some of the parts.
Yeah, I mean, it's good sort of back it. But I'm with you can quite easily get to well north of a pound.
Okay, good. We've got James. He's asking about the software, basically Netcall, which has their sort of like iconic Liberty software platform, which I think serves all sort of call centers of probably financial institutions, again, in sort of insurers and stuff like that. How do you see this one going forward? It's in terms of contact centers, where that secular growth is going to come from for it.
Yeah, I think this is a business that has evolved massively over the last few years. We've been a long-standing shareholder. We've been the largest shareholder in Netcall for a number of years. And you know, it's evolved itself from a number of point software solutions into a genuine platform that is able to plug in incremental sort of capability and deliver that quite seamlessly to its customers. And the key markets, you mentioned financial services insurance, that's one. The other is UK government sector, so local authorities and NHS trusts. And whilst you might kind of flinch and think that that's not a great sector, the government doesn't have loads of money, it's you know, it's a difficult procurement sort of space, actually the company's been delivering very strong performance in that sector. And the reason is because they have a really easy to use plug and play setup that helps its customers automate business processes to drive efficiency. And there's one thing that the sort of both the NHS and local authorities need at the moment, it's efficiency in running their services so they can kind of make what money they do have stretch further. So the company's got really good traction there, and it's got really good referenceability. So typically NHS trusts and local authorities, you know, they do tend to sort of follow each other, and there's quite a close-knit community. And where someone is implemented something that is demonstrably giving them a really high ROI, they talk about it and people notice, and that's been driving sort of referrals and therefore sort of additional wins in that space. And as you said, also the insurance space is another, but not dissimilar to ActiveOps. And the story there is that they're enabling business processes to be automated, and that drives efficiency. And again, AI plays a part in that. It's the kind of huge buzzword everywhere, and there's gigantic amounts of investment going into these sort of generative AI models, but they're still going to be pointed at something in order to actually drive efficiencies or build other benefits for end users. And Netcall is a great platform through which AI can be implemented into some of these organizations that you know, desperately need efficiency. And you can, you know, the government are keen for government agencies and entities to deploy AI, but they probably don't really know exactly how to do that themselves. Yeah. And so coming out of Netcall can handhold them into doing that and sort of offer them a platform that enables them to effectively build a business application really simply with no coding required, and actually deliver tangible savings quite quickly. So yeah. Another one we think big market opportunity, great platform, and accelerating growth rates, which, you know, is there seem to be a few of these little software companies in the UK which are doing well, but the market just hasn't been recognising the value properly.
Yeah, well, the shares have done pretty well. But just in terms of that longevity of contact centres, because if you're sort of like a sceptic and you were saying, okay, well, you've got now generative AI or agentic AI, and you can basically sort your problem out without having to ring somebody up or send them a text or do your chat box sort of like calls, you can just sort it out yourself, then won't the market overall for call centers or contact centers shrink because the person can just self-diagnose, self-solve at the coal face rather than having to get somebody else involved?
Yeah, but you still need to plug into the systems of the company that you're interacting with, where there is a problem that you need to do something with, and that this company provides that application, which, you know, that your customer engagement application. So whether you're calling someone up in a call center, and as you would have done 10 years ago, or chatting with a chatbot, which is powered by agentic AI, or you're kind of plugging into to a system using AI, you still need that interface. It still needs to be secure. It still needs to actually sort of provide the data that you need. And that's what this company's platform does. So it's, you know, it's multi-channel interaction. So the key thing is that controlling the interface between the customer and the business processes that are sitting within in the corporate or the entity that they're dealing with.
Yeah, they're basically the conduit. They're the mechanism, the mechanics to be able to let somebody self-diagnose themselves, because they get you into your inquiry or your inquiry.
Your NHS trust or your insurance company, they're not sort of allowing you to plug directly, allowing ChatGPT to plug directly into their systems. There has to be a gatekeeper.
I wish they would at times. Okay, right, let's move to industrials. We've got Drew. He's asking about franchise brands that I think has got a lot of different moving parts. It's got its filter oil cleaning, cooking oil cleaning business in the UK and in the US, which I think is doing okay. It's also got a hose business, but it's basically B2B franchises that it operates. Shares haven't performed particularly well. Anyway, he's asking what's your latest thoughts on it.
Yeah, you're right. So the shares have sort of been stuck for a while. We actually we owned both this business and we owned Filter when Filter was a listed company, and the two the franchise brands acquired Filter largely for shares. They did a couple of years ago, they made a pretty material acquisition of the hose business Pertec, which is the European wide franchise for Pertec. There's a separate US franchise, which they don't own, which is owned by private equity. And they leveraged up the balance sheet materially to do that acquisition. And whilst we think the business they bought is attractive and it sort of fitted with the strategy, it is also a business that is to some degree exposed to the business cycle, the business activity. Yeah. So some part of it is just you have to do something, and therefore the kind of response maintenance business is pretty resilient, but some of it that's planned, people may defer spending decisions if times are a bit tougher. So I think they've suffered from that. The fact that the company had leverage as well and the numbers have been a bit soft, has just meant that the market is sort of taking a let's see you deliver before we give you the rating back kind of approach. So it feels like that's settled now. I think the businesses that you mentioned, the filter business is doing well. The hose business has been doing okay in some bits and less so in others. They've done a refresh of the management team, and you know, this business now is on a pretty undemanding rating for what, yeah, for what is a high quality business model. We really like franchise business models because they are capital light. You get high returns on capital and high margins, good cash generation when it's firing properly. So we think this, if this business starts to sort of show a bit of an improvement in the growth rates, you should get a pretty meaningful re-rating gain.
Yeah, just on that Pirec business, is it the cyclical side which is obviously putting a bit of a challenge, or is it they've got to fire up the bellies of those franchisees in Pirec, you know, to basically in Europe to really sell those hose services? Because that's the sort of the meat, that's really the sort of the acid test when it comes to success if you're a franchise owner, is firing up and incentivizing those franchisees to have a win-win for you and for them.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, you can't have a successful franchise business unless the franchisees themselves are making money and are kind of fired up and you know, acting like entrepreneurs. But then that's the reason why these businesses are attractive. If you get that right, you know, they're doing all the work for you. And you get a really experienced management team at the helm here, very, very used to sort of that franchisee management piece and trying to get that right. This, you know, I think just taking a bit longer than maybe we had hoped for when they acquired Pirtek 2 years ago.
Yeah. Okay, good. In the same industrial sector, let's move to high speed packaging and factory automation business, MPAC, that did a couple of big acquisitions last year, raised some money. It basically helps manufacturers in food and beverage and pharmaceuticals to improve and automate all of their sort of product, well, basically their packaging systems and automate their production services and the cartoning and stuff like that. And then unfortunately got hit by the tariffs, which did, as manufacturers didn't know where they were going to put factories and investment in their production lines, it was a bit of a standstill. Anyway, they came out with a stabilized position in the last trading update. And they saw the order book. What's sort of your latest on this business?
Yeah, I think again, you sort of covered the issues and what happened, which has sort of hit them in the short term. Fortunately, this is a business that has a really strong underlying position. It's got its products are good. It's got a good customer base. It's just that there was a sort of market uncertainty which led to delayed decision making for obvious reasons, and I think that it's encouraging to see that things appear to have stabilized now. So we think this is an undervalued business. We think it's a big market opportunity. You know, they have the opportunity to both grow organically but also to restart bolt-on acquisitions in due course. We think CEO has got a really clear view of what he needs to do and you know, is a really good operator. So we're confident that it's been a bit of a hiccup, but that now things are stabilized. We should start to see growth again in due course.
Yeah. How do you think the Trump's big, beautiful tax bill will play into this? Because that then incentivizes people to reshore production to the US and to, if they've had any doubt, to actually sign some CapEx checks, because they get 100% capital allowances now to bring production or to put production lines in place. Mm-hmm. How do you think that's going to play? Because that's only just come into force. I think it was the end of July, I think it came in as the first day.
Yeah, I think in theory it's a positive, but I suspect it takes quite a bit of time to play out, and so I wouldn't be relying on that. I don't think you've got much sort of reflected in forecasts for this company sort of in the short term. So you know, it's sort of not an unhelpful backdrop, but I think I wouldn't be sort of holding my breath for that really sort of hit very in the near term.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Cool. We've got Richard. He's asking about Outsource Capita, which basically does all things for public and private sector, sort of like You know, anything to do with personnel, technology led. I think it runs the congestion chart. It's one of a sort of like a Marmite stock. Certain people love it, and some people think of, oh, crikey, you know, it's come down from about 25 quid over 20 years to whatever it is, about 3 quid now. How do you see this one going?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a special situation, but it is one which I suspect a lot of people haven't looked at for quite a long time. And it's the sort of the association is with a massive fallen angel, having been a FTSE 100 company at one point and then unwound horribly over a protracted period. I think Adolfo, he's not so new anymore, but the current CEO who came in, 3 years ago, I think, his background is in big technology transformations and managing big sort of outsourced organizations. In fact, he ran AWS in Europe for.
Oh, wow. Okay.
He is an operator who I think has the vision for what Capita should become. And it's a big digital transformation story, really. Capita, I think, has a lot of good tech in it. It's got great customers. But it's on this sort of trajectory to shift from effectively being a kind of BPO outsourced body shop type proposition to being a technology enabled service provider. It's not quite there yet, but if it manages to do that, then the rating is completely the wrong rating. So I think the market is looking for a couple of things. It's looking for earnings to start going in the right direction and for cash generation to come through. And it's the latter part in particular that has really probably been a bit disappointing over the last 3 or 4 years. It's taken longer for cash to start coming through from this business, other than from disposals of non-core operations. If you start to see positive operating cash flow from the company, I think that will be a real catalyst for the share price to start performing.
Yeah. I mean, it's only trades on less than 8x PE. Mm-hmm. So you're right. It's priced to a lot of bad news already in that. But in terms of outsourcing and BPO, and I know it's moving up to more the tech side, but how competitive is that space when you're competing against, I don't know, the Indian guys and big Europeans, I don't know, whoever it is. But it always seems to be quite low margin and highly competitive, this space.
It is very competitive. So I think you need scale and or technology to be able to do that effectively. I mean, Capita obviously do have contact center operations in various international locations. So it's not that, I mean, they are sort of able to exploit that labor arbitrage opportunity as well as sort of international competitors. But really the key thing is the technology. It's over time automating as much as possible. And again, it's a bit of a theme that we've talked about a few times already, but becoming the conduit, the way in which their customers can implement AI and other automation technologies to drive operational efficiencies or agility. That's the proposition that they need. They are sort of starting to be delivering to their customers, but they're not a pure play of that yet. If they get there, then this is a really valuable business. And so I think the key here is it's the execution of this transformation of their proposition to be a technology first vendor. Vision's there. I think the management team are there, and it's just going to take time, and they need to sort of demonstrate to the market that they're actually delivering that strategy.
I'm with you. It's a bit of a show me story. If they show it, then it will re-rate materially. Another one which is a bit of a show me story, in fact, more of a show me story. We've got Dan asking about data center company IOMart that was a darling, and it's really now split investor opinion, and people have written it off as a value trap. Is there any value here? Because they made a big acquisition at a pretty big price, ATEC, I think, last year. And they're trying to obviously de-gear. But what's your sort of latest on this one? Shares are almost all-time lows.
We are, just to full disclosure, we are the largest shareholder here. We own 29% of the company. So we are sort of all in on
bullish
recovery. This story has not played out the way that we hoped it would do. And you can't get away from that in the chart that you can see there. Just that, you know, that tells you all you need to know about it. But you know, we think there are levers that they can pull to turn it around and recover value. You referenced the ATEC acquisition. Yeah. So ATEC is a Microsoft Azure focused managed service provider. That the acquisition of ATEC, which we think is a really good business, by the way, was on strategy, which is for the company to transition its offerings from legacy private sort of data center provision of which some was quite commoditized, into being a more of a hybrid cloud solutions provider and providing the managed service layer between sort of mid-sized corporates and SMEs and the hyperscalers who don't really want to deal with them directly. ATEC really moved forward their sort of Microsoft exposure and their and also their technical capability in that space. Unfortunately, they funded it. It was a relatively expensive price, although the business has outperformed their expectations at an acquisition. And they funded it with debt. And that was a big mistake in hindsight. And it's a mistake that cost the old CEO her job. So ultimately, and unfortunately, the sort of combination of that acquisition and the debt funding with actually the legacy part of IMR underperforming. So churn in their self-managed infrastructure business was ahead of where the management team had expected it to be. And that's quite high margin, quite cash generative revenue, even though it's sort of in decline. And so that suddenly meant the balance sheet looked overstretched. Mm. So the business they bought was fine, that's performing well, but the group's balance sheet was too highly geared, particularly for the stock market's sort of current view of what appropriate leverage levels should be. And that's led to a huge derating of the equity.
Yeah.
I think that the path to recovery is initially de-gearing and also demonstrating a stabilization that those churn rates in the old part of the business. They've done the latter, or at least in the most recent numbers that they had showed that churn stabilized in the self-managed part of the business, but they still need to get the debt down. There's a few levers they could potentially pull there. They've got some parts of the business which potentially they could divest to bring down the debt. There are also cost savings that they can take out to improve the profitability, so the leverage doesn't look so challenging. There's freehold property assets within the group which potentially could be monetized to bring down debt. So there's a few different things they can do. The interim executive chair, Richard Last, is someone that we think is very capable and, you know, is very focused on shareholder value creation. So we think we've got someone decent in there who can try and sort of move things forward. But again, it's a bit like the capital story, that the market needs to see some of those things actually happening before it's going to get positively re-rated.
Yeah, it should be in exactly the right space. I mean, when you look at it top level cyclical, I mean, people want AI, people want data centers, it's a massive boom, and you can't connect new ones to the grid, you can't get power for them. So having existing ones, existing expertise in it should be well sought after, but the shares have just tanked. And
Which is why I think it's there's a lot of value here. It just needs a catalyst to unlock it.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. If they can, if they can actually get that debt down and start getting top line growth and showing that operating leverage come through, I think it will be a totally different story. Good. Okay, we've got Sarah. She's asking about drinks company Nichols, which I think is famous for the iconic Vimto brand. They must have had a stormer during the summer, I would have thought. But what's your sort of latest view? Because it was obviously this year has been so hot in Western Europe.
Yeah, this business is a great brand, Vimto. It's still surprisingly probably underpenetrated, particularly in the south of England. There was a sort of originally a northwest of England sort of focused brand. We think we've got an excellent management team in this business who kind of really know the levers to pull. So you've got a successful business that's had good momentum in the UK. Sort of core part of the business, sticking to the knitting and then do some sort of sensible brand extensions or partnerships with third parties as well. And then you've got quite an exciting international growth story. And this business has been a stalwart in the Middle East for years and years and years. And that business is going well, but there's a big opportunity to grow in Africa when they've just they're shifting from being a with their local partners effectively shifting to local manufacturing, which should be a big game changer for the margin structure for the partner there, which means they can invest more in trying to drive growth. So you've got a domestic UK core business penetration growth story, and then you've got an international growth story on top. And because of the way that their business model works internationally, where they're effectively selling the concentrate, they're not sort of manufacturing the product and then shipping it out to wherever across the globe. It's actually a really sort of low capital intensity, high margin growth story in those regions.
Why do they need, they've got 60 odd million of net cash on the balance sheet. Why do they need so much cash, given they're a pretty high repeat type of revenue product that has been, you know, you can, if you're a finance director, it should be easy, relatively easy to forecast. Do you really need 60 odd million of net cash on your balance sheet?
The answer to that's probably not.
Yeah. Okay.
They've got a decent dividend yield. But there's potential for incremental returns of capital, returns to shareholders rather. That balance sheet, yes, for sure.
Okay, good. Well, let's move to we've got Emma. She's asking about Spire Healthcare, the UK's biggest private hospital business. I think it's got about 40 facilities there. Has had a bit of a stumble when the NI increased at the start of the year. It couldn't transfer those through its contracts, particularly to the US. It went through an efficiency drive and now has apparently put itself up for sale. So how do you see this one playing out over the next 6 to 12 months?
I think this is a business that, when you look at it against the value of its assets, so it's, it owns a lot of really quite valuable freehold land and buildings and where the hospitals are, then it looks really, really undervalued. And I think that's what's been kind of pushed by a couple of the larger shareholders here who've been quite vocal about what the management team should do. And that's resulted in the board effectively saying, "Yeah, okay, we will properly explore that option to see whether that can unlock value for us." And I think that there's a couple of ways they could do that. That it's sell the whole company potentially, or there's some kind of sale and lease back type transaction with the freehold property to unlock value that way. But either way you look at it, if that calculus is correct, that the value of the freehold property is sort of means you're not paying very much of anything for the actual operating business, then the management team have to take that pretty seriously and try and sort of find a way to demonstrate that's true.
Yeah, and I think they should be a secular beneficiary of getting the waiting list down, shouldn't they, in the UK, because it's still about 7 million people.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, I think the NHS is about 25% of their revenue.
So they provide things like hip replacements and knee replacements and such like for the NHS to drive down some people's waiting times. But they're also benefiting from a shift to number one, more private medical insurance that organisations provide to their employees as benefits, and so that penetration of PMI sort of increasing, and then also possibly as a result of the frustration by NHS waiting list, more self-pay as well. So people actually going, I prefer to pay myself than have to wait for 2 years to have this procedure done. So that all three of those bits are being growing at a reasonable rate. But as you say, it's the cost side of the equation, which is sort of tripped them up, through no fault of their own, but they've taken action to try and address that. And we think the management team are pretty good operators and will be successful. So we think the profits will kind of be preserved regardless of whether the sort of corporate transaction happens or not.
Hmm. How long do you think that strategic review might last then? Is it sort of six months? Is that the sort of timescales?
I mean, these things typically take sort of 6 months. I'd say it depends on what they've been doing behind the scenes before they announced that, and if they had sort of active interest in the business, and obviously we have no sort of specific insight into that. If you're having a strategic review for longer than 6 months, then I think it starts to become a bit of a distraction. So hopefully they can either do something rapidly or they can move on and start focusing on the business again.
Good. Okay, let's go down the size scale in healthcare and life sciences. We've got David. He's asking about IXICO, which is an expert in all things sort of like MRI scans and brain scans. It helps biopharma companies develop new drugs and treatments in things like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and Huntington's. How do you see this one going forward?
Yeah, and this fits into one of the themes that we really like in healthcare, which is specialist service providers providing something that into the drug development ecosystem that the big pharma companies don't have or don't have as good a capability in-house. So specialist sort of outsourcing of components of the value chain. And so as you say, this company is providing sort of expertise in medical imaging, specifically in relation to neurodegenerative diseases. That sort of therapeutic area is a big growth area. There's a lot of money being invested by big pharma companies in trying to sort of find therapies for Alzheimer's and other Huntington's, etc. that you mentioned. And this company is a valuable piece of the puzzle there, which can either help to improve the accuracy of drugs that are being developed, or can reduce the time and therefore the cost to finding new therapies. It's had a bit of a checkered history over its life as a listed company. It's got great underpinning IP in the business and good position and great customers, but being pretty small player and being geared into projects it's been sort of almost a victim of its own success, because it had some quite big lumpy contracts, which then when one or two of those sort of rolled off, and if they weren't replaced, the earnings sort of were hit materially as a result of that. There's been a refresh of the management team in the last year or two, and we feel like they are sort of back on a sort of positive trajectory. They had a capital markets day a couple of weeks ago, and it was very well attended, considering this is a sort of 10 million market cap company. But it's a small market cap company doing something quite interesting in a gigantic market where there's billions of dollars being invested. So we think that that's pretty decent sort of backdrop for this business to be successful if they execute.
Yeah, no, I think they've got some pretty good endorsements, haven't they? Because they were the power, they were the technology behind the development of that first Huntington's disease treatment, and also for the world first diagnostic, blood-based diagnostic for Alzheimer's. So they've definitely been punching above their weight in the industry.
Yeah.
Another one who's been punching above their weight is Cuth, and we've got Colin. He's asking about, this is basically a specialist in the UK that does mental health services to young adults and to children, particularly into schools, I think, got very good reputation. And they won that massive, massive contract, $300 million thing out in California. They've also had one in New Jersey. How do you see this one going forward? I cannot believe how cheap it is for something in sort of like life sciences, med tech.
Yeah, so this is a really good business doing great stuff, and so I guess providing upstream support before conditions get really acute, and so there's a benefit to the individual that uses their services, because hopefully it kind of gives them support and tools for them to be able to deal with mental health issues before they become acute, and then for the health services perspective, it costs a lot less to deal with somebody sort of in a preventative way early than it does if it becomes really acute and they have to go to hospital sort of further down the line. So it's doing good stuff. It's great social benefit. In the UK, they have suffered. So when this business floated, I think it was £2 a share. It was significantly above where the share's currently trading. It was a pure UK NHS focused business, and they've suffered a bit. The growth there has sort of faltered because the NHS has been restructured in terms of how it procures, and just because of a sort of slowdown in decision making. So the UK business has not been growing very fast, which I guess initially was offset, more than offset, by that big California contract you mentioned. Mm. And that the California contract has, it was huge. I guess you have the same kind of comment of a bit of a victim of their own success, in that they rightly put a lot of resource into trying to build up that contract, and it's generated a lot of revenue and a lot of cash flow for them. They've been able to use that contract to significantly invest in the core product and improve it dramatically, which has been great for the business. But the share price has been hit by some material uncertainty around whether that contract gets renewed or not. And if it doesn't, obviously that's pretty material for the group. And so the price at the moment is sort of reflecting that uncertainty. If you step back from that a bit, you go, well, even if they did lose that contract, which we hope they won't, and you know, they're obviously doing everything they can to try and ensure it's renewed, you will have a UK business which is still a solid business, even if it hasn't grown as much as they'd hoped previously, and a totally re-engineered product which they haven't actually rolled out into the UK business yet, which they can do, which should drive sort of more efficiency for the UK and better features for the NHS. So could be the catalyst to sort of kickstart growth again in the UK. So if you just had that, you've probably got a better business than you had at IPO. Yeah, the price is massively below where the IPO price was. That's even aside from the cash they've generated from the California contract. Plus, you do have optionality for that to be renewed. There are other US states that be a lot smaller, but where there's potential as well. So, this business just doesn't seem like the right price, and that's down to the uncertainty on California. And clearly, it won't be a positive if they don't renew that. But even if they don't, I think you can sort of justify the current value, and more so than without having to sort of have that contract in there. And if they do win it, then the share is completely the wrong price.
Yeah, no, I agree. When does that renewal happen? Do you know?
So it's during next year, so mid 2026.
Okay.
It's a bit unclear as to precisely when. So there's not a kind of clear date where it's a kind of go no go. It's because the nature of the contract is it would transition. So instead of being a special project in California, it would be sort of embedded into the local delivery organizations. And so there's not a kind of a drop dead date on it. But it's during next year, you should have clarity.
And how easy is it to take their system out? I mean, if you're somebody of a child and you're getting support, mental health or therapist or, online and stuff by Couth, and frankly, if you then suddenly get that ripped out of you and move to another one, it's going to be pretty distressing for literally probably 50 to 100,000. I mean, it's going to have lots of social consequences regardless of the financial ones.
Which makes it difficult. But I guess the question is who's paying for it and which budgets are coming out of. And so there's just uncertainty around that whole area. And this was a big pet project of Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, and he's sort of he's coming to the end of his term next year as well. So that's it needs a political sponsor. But I agree with you. There are kind of potential negative headlines to be had if it's just forced. People are forced off the support.
No, I would certainly say so. Okay, good. Let's move sectors. We've got financial services. Nikki's asking about FinTel, which basically I think helps IFAs and people buy better products on financial services, whether it's investment funds, whether it's mortgages and all that kind of stuff. Plus, I think it helps also product providers also reach the customers that they need. Mm-hmm. What's the latest on this one?
Yeah, it's been curious. This business has been derated fairly meaningfully over the course of the last 12 months. Despite the fact that it has actually delivered quite some decent numbers and has been performing quite well, they as you said, it's. I mean, the way I think about this is, it's a business that has made a material transition from being effectively an outsourced service provider to IFAs, providing compliance services and administrative software and information about funds, and it's transitioned itself into what I would describe as a sort of two-sided platform business, where it's providing data insights and support to the IFAs on one side, but also using that same data insight and support to provide to the product providers for them to kind of access distribution and also to develop better product, which is more suited to the end market. So, but the business is not really being valued as a platform. If other two-sided platform businesses are typically extremely highly rated because they're really valuable, very sticky. They made a number of bolt-on acquisitions within the last couple of years, which were really about technical capability. And that technical capability, we think, is the opportunity that they have to scale that into their existing customer base is really strong. But those businesses, some of them were loss-making when they bought them because they were sort of technology, not startups, but they were pretty early-stage businesses. And that diluted the growth rate at the profit level for the company. It was quite easy to understand what was going on there. That they were quite transparent about what was happening. But I think the headline growth rate faltered a little bit as a result of that dilution, and that's probably one of the reasons the shares have been derated. But as far as we understand it, those businesses have been integrated. They're starting to get decent traction from selling those services into their customer base, and so we think. There's a decent chance of the profit growth starting to re-accelerate. And if that happens, again, you should see a catalyst for a re-rating.
Yeah, I think about two-thirds of their revenues is recurring as well, isn't it? So it's a pretty nice, easy, predictable business. Mm-hmm. You'd have thought so. Okay, final one in the financial services. We've got a new IPO. We've got MHA. Harry's asking about it. And I think it IPO at about £1 and... I think it's trading at above that. It basically offers audit and tax and professional services in the UK, part of the Baker Tilly sort of like, it's an independent group, but a part of the Baker Tilly, and then has gone on a buy and build as well. How do you see this one?
Yeah, so we were one of the cornerstone investors in that IPO, which pretty much was timed within a few days of Trump's sort of Liberation Day tariff announcement. So it was a pretty tough time to in markets to be floating. But they got it away, and it was actually, I think it was the biggest, by a meaningful amount, they raised 98 million at IPO, and that 98 out of a total of 160 in the whole of the London market in the first half of this year. So it was pretty good going to get that away. And it was, and in contrast to all the sort of negativity about the death of the AIM market, this was an AIM IPO in April this year. Raising decent amount of money. As you say, it's an accounting services business. It's part of the Baker Tilly International network. And it's a platform for what is going on in this sort of accounting services market, which is a sort of reconsolidation below the Big Four. We've had all this kind of fallout from the Big Four consultancy firms. They've had sort of conflicts of interest and FRC fines and sort of issues with some big audits, which has meant they've had to sort of let go some customers, or some customers have sort of reappraised with the Big Four as kind of the be all and end all when you're having your audit. You've also seen big audit fees because of those fines and the risk. Yeah. Audit fees have been going up, so companies have been shopping around a bit more and looking at the sort of next tier of firms. And the last thing is, in the private equity world, contrary to what you might think, actually accountancy services is a hot market. Now, it's pretty exciting. There's a lot of private equity money going into platform businesses of like MHA to fund consolidation of smaller firms into those businesses. Mm. And we think the market backdrop is really quite attractive because you've got price rises coming through, so typically inflation linkage to contracts. You've got multi-year contracts. These are regulatory driven services. You don't have a choice as to whether you have an audit or not. You've got to do it, and so there's good underpin and visibility to contracts. And the reason why MHA decided to float rather than to do a private equity transaction is because they didn't want to have private equity capital structure, which would have had sort of material debt on the balance sheet, because they wanted the flexibility to they kind of be in control of their own destiny. And when they floated, you know, one of the key bits of rationale was trying to enable equity ownership further down the organization than would typically be the case in a private company. And so, you know, floating, they were, I guess, less price sensitive at IPO than some companies would be, because they wanted to kind of get equity into the hands of their sort of fear further down the business. And they wanted equity available as potential consideration for acquisition, so they can bind people into the long-term story rather than just cashing them out like private equity would typically do. And that seems to have worked so far. It's resonated. They've made an acquisition since the IPO, and shares are up sort of 40-odd percent versus that April price that it listed at. So it's been a good investment so far. But we're not, you know, we're looking at this as a 3 to 5 year holding period rather than a sort of 6 months.
That's amazing, isn't it? Audit is an exciting area. And I guess in 2 weeks' time, because tax is going to change, they should do well out of tax advice as well, particularly for wealthy people who have had enough of the government and want to sort of, like, you know, go abroad. Okay, good. We've come to the end of the interview. But before we sort of close, Ken, I don't suppose there's a sort of like a sort of favourite stock idea for the next 12 months you could share with people, whether it's some company we've discussed already or another one that you've been running the slider all over.
Yeah, look, we've been buying, and over the course of the last few months, we've significantly increased our position. Is Brooks Macdonald. So Brooks Macdonald is UK wealth manager and advice business. It's been under relatively new management, so the current CEO has been in for just over a year. She was CFO for a year or so before that. They divested their international business, which was Channel Islands based, sold that to Canaccord. They've moved from AIM to the main market, and they've sort of been significantly beefing up the management team below the exec board. They've also made a couple of bolt-on acquisitions of advice businesses over the last 12 months. There's lots been going on under the surface, but the business is not really yet got credit for all the work that they've been doing, because the market's very focused on assets under management growth. And they've got two bits to their AUM business. One is MPS, so Managed Portfolio Service business, that's growing double digit top line and is really motoring. It's a bit like a Tatton asset management, which has been growing, you know, a bit smaller, but similar to Tatton's, similar growth rates. And then they've got what they call their BPS business, a bespoke portfolio service business, which has been going slightly backwards over the last couple of years for various reasons. We think that they're poised for that business to stabilize and start to grow incrementally. If they do that, then the aggregate AUM will start to grow materially. If they deliver a few quarters of positive net inflows into their business in aggregate, we think the business has got a great chance of being re-rated positively. The good thing about this is the valuation is really undemanding. So it's trading on about 8x EV EBITDA. That's, you know, it's at least a third, if not half, of the valuation multiples you've seen from multiple transactions in private equity. There've been a lot of consolidation in private equity activity in this space. Most recently, even look at public companies. Mattioli Woods got taken private by Pollen Street at 12.5x EV EBITDA last year. So Brooks trades at a big discount to Mattioli Woods. We don't think that's as warranted, and we think that just incremental growth in terms of net flows will be the catalyst for that that to change in the next 12 months.
Yeah, you have real expertise, don't you, in the sort of the M&A of this sector? Because wasn't Gresham House taken out by private or somebody about 2 years ago?
Yeah, Gresham House was taken private by Searchlight Capital Partners, who are a US and UK private equity firm.
Yeah. What was the multiple on that one?
It was about 13x EV/EBITDA, but I mean, slightly different businesses. But yeah. There's been a lot of private equity activity in this FS space in general, but particularly the wealth and advice space, at pretty high multiples. And Brooks just looks completely just looks out of kilter with that activity.
Yeah, well, I mean, crikey, you know, you guys are experts in this M&A area, so that's a really brilliant idea for people to have a good look and do some research. So fantastic way to close it. So thanks very much, Ken. Thanks, everyone, for your questions, and look forward in touching base in the next sort of 6 to 12 months. So thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.